I saw a switch, so I just had to find it. Thank you guys for coming out tonight. It's good to see all of you here. How many of you have ever been to a trafficking presentation before? Anybody? Okay. Yeah, I brought my hairdresser with me because when I put this thing on, you know, you got to make sure your hair looks okay. I'm sitting there going, okay, what do you think? So this kind of all started for me. My daughter-in-law went to India on a missions trip back when she was in college, and she went to work with women who had been trafficked. And when she came back from India, she shared what she had experienced with me, and it literally just broke my heart. I couldn't even imagine what she saw because it was right there in front of you on the streets. And after she shared with me, I just knew that I had to do something. And my husband was a pastor. He passed away in 2017, very suddenly, right before we were getting ready to open up our safe house. And I thought initially that I would be raising money to send to countries like India, Thailand, Cambodia, but God had another plan. He continued to just break my heart over this issue, and I started doing a lot of research. I was online all the time trying to find information about trafficking. Every time I got on there, I would run into the term domestic sex trafficking or domestic minor sex trafficking, which means it's happening here in the United States. And so the more I researched, the more I realized that there was a huge need for people to come together and help individuals who'd been trafficked. Initially, we thought that we would open up a safe house for children. And then, you know, when you start looking at New York State law and regulations and certifications, it became almost impossible for us to do that because we are a faith-based organization. So we decided to open up a home for individuals who are coming out of trafficking who are ages 18 and up. So back in, gosh, it was 2012 when I started to kind of do my research and learn everything I could about trafficking. And then in 2013, we formed our 501c3, got a board of directors together, and just started kind of educating people. I brought people into our community who could help kind of spread the message kind of like this, you know, just talking about it and learning about it. And then shortly after, I really felt God calling me to open up a home for women coming out of trafficking. So we began in 2014 raising money at the end of 2014. And then in 2016, we broke ground on a project. But there's a whole bunch of stuff that happened between, you know, point A and point B. But one of my favorite stories, I knew this guy in our community. He was a builder, and he built the most beautiful homes. You guys know Corning Incorporated, I'm sure, Pyrex, all that stuff. Well, he was building like Wendell Weeks' home. He's the head guy for Corning, and all the people that worked right underneath him. But I knew that he was a good guy. I didn't have any intention of building a home. I just wanted to find something like an old farmhouse. We could fix it up. We could use this. So I put his name on my list in, gosh, probably 2014, something like that. I had this list on my computer. And I didn't contact him until a year later. 6 months after I wrote his name down on my list, someone offered us acreage and said, you know, we'd like to donate 5 acres of land. And I thought, that's great. We can take the girls camping. We can, you know, we can sell it and make money for whatever to build the house to buy a house. But then the day that my husband and I went and looked at the property, instantly we knew this is where the house was supposed to be. So I knew we were building, and I was scared to death. And so I contacted this guy, Bill, who is a builder, and I said, hey, here's this project I'm working on. And he said, well, how did you get my name? And I said, I just know of you. I'm friends with these friends that you know. And I said, I've had your name on my list for a year. And he said, well, that's interesting, because I just told my wife yesterday that if God ever asked me to be involved in the fight against human trafficking, I couldn't say no. It's like, okay, you know. And for me, at that point, it was huge confirmation. Because I was an eighth grade English teacher, guys. When you step out of your comfort zone to do something completely different for God, he shows up in a huge, huge and powerful way. And we've seen that from the beginning. So we opened our doors in 2018 to our first resident. And God doesn't do anything halfway. Like, we have this gorgeous 9,000 square foot home that is just phenomenal. It's like a mansion. In fact, when the residents write home about it, if they have a home to write home to, they often talk about how they live in a mansion. And, you know, they walk in and they look around and they're like, wow, I get to live here. So just to kind of get back to basics, what is trafficking? Obviously, it's a hidden crime. People don't go around publicizing that they are traffickers. What county are you guys in here? Allegheny, that's right, you mentioned that. So I remember early on meeting with the sheriff of Steuben County, and he said to me, trafficking and drugs go hand in hand. If you have one, you have the other. And that's everywhere, guys, everywhere. Drug traffickers or drug dealers know that they can make more money off of an individual that they can sell over and over and over again if they can control them in some way. So they use the drugs to control them. They use power and control. They use fear. They use whatever they can. And we'll talk more about what that looks like. So obviously, it's a hidden crime, and it involves force, fraud, or coercion. Anytime a commercial sex act happens for an exchange of something of value. So for example, this 16-year-old girl lives in the cul-de-sac, and there's a 21-year-old neighbor who says, if you do this sexual favor for me, I'll put gas in your car. We would think of that as probably just sexual abuse, right? That is actually considered trafficking, especially because that individual is under the age of 18. It's automatically trafficking. Now, there's a whole lot of people that need to catch up on this definition, like, you know, law enforcement, courts, but there's a whole lot of education that has happened. When I first started this back in 2012, I was clueless, and so many other people were clueless. Now, law enforcement is required to take trafficking training classes, as are medical professionals, hotel owners, hospitals, you name it. People, teachers, everybody is now kind of pulling this in so that they can start to recognize signs. So when you think about anything of value being exchanged, it could be money, it could be food, it could be drugs, shelter, clothing, cigarettes, like I said. Are there any teachers in here? Okay. Elementary, middle, high school? Okay. So, you know, there are kids who are trafficked. In fact, the first time, have any of you ever been to Sparkle in Corning? It's the Christmas festival. So our very first year, we set up a booth at Sparkle in Corning, and our first customer to come to the booth told us that three kids had just been removed from their parents' home that week because they'd been trafficked by their parents in our community. And the youngest one was 3 years old, and the oldest was 16. So what happens often, and this is what we see a lot with our residents, is that parents who are drug addicts will want the drug more than they're willing to protect their kids because the drugs take over. It's not that they don't want to protect their kids. I don't want you to think that, I mean, when you look at it like that, anyone who could sell their small 3-year-old child, you think monster, but drugs are so, so powerful that they completely take over and people have no power until, you know, somebody, hopefully they have some kind of redemption. There is trafficking in every state of the United States. You know, people often think because we are from the Corning area that there's a lot of trafficking that happens in Corning. It's not any different in Corning than it is anywhere else. It happens all over the place. If you see drugs on the news, you've got trafficking. And just so you know, a lot of the women that come from to us come from all over the country. They're not just coming from our region. In fact, if we have someone in our area who has been trafficked locally, we refer them outside of the area because it's safer for them to start over somewhere else. So that's always our goal. When you think about sexual exploitation, think of things like prostitution, pornography, sexual performance, dancing, you know, strip clubs, that kind of thing. And remember that I said anyone under the age of 18, it's automatically considered trafficking. So up to 300,000 American children are at risk of being exploited every year. I would guess that that number is way higher than that. When you look at the statistics of individuals being trafficked, or I'm sorry, sexually abused, it's typically 1 in 5 or 1 in 4 girls. And so if you start looking at the definition and what's actually happening, it's way higher than what we could ever imagine. The average age a child is first exploited is 12. But children much younger, including infants, have been seen in videos. I've got some kids coming in, so I'm going to just be careful how I say things moving forward. So often, when you think about what it looks like in the United States, and especially in a community like this, you know, you don't have the big strip like you would have in New York City or even Rochester, New York. You have this happening in homes. You have it happening in hotels. You have it happening in cars. We've had residents who were told or driven to sporting events, and customers are in the parking lots of the sporting events. The truck stop in Canona, you know, that's another huge thing where girls are taken in the back, or I say girls because that's who we work with. We work with women. So when I say that, just know that that can also mean men, boys. But we work with women ages 18 and up. I often do sometimes work with younger individuals and their families, but not in our residential program. So one of the first trafficking victims I had ever met was a young woman who grew up in Batavia, New York, and her mom was a heroin addict, and she ended up, the mom had men coming in and out of the house on a regular basis, and she was abused by them, and so she ended up running away from home at age 14, ended up out on the streets, and became a heroin addict herself, and immediately got picked up by a trafficker. And so she was trafficked in the back of a box truck, where they would drive around to truck stops, and they would drive to different sporting events and locations, and that's how she was trafficked, moving around. One of my pet peeves about this whole trafficking issue, as far as the legal side of things, is that when an individual turns 18, it becomes much harder for them to prosecute their traffickers, because so much more has to go into the investigation. If it's a minor, it's just easier. They just kind of look at it. They look at things a lot quicker, and they say, okay, you know, you're definitely a trafficking victim because we can see that this was an exchange. So if you think of an individual who may have been trafficked since they were 12 years old, but nobody knew about it until they were 21, you know, it should be the same all the way through. Any law enforcement in here? Okay. Some myths and misconceptions of human trafficking. So a lot of times people think that the trafficking victim knew what they were getting into. I can tell you that almost every single one of the residents that we've had in our house, and that's about 35, 36 women over the course of 3 years, did not know what they were getting into. One woman that I've been working with since 2014 was offered a job by a friend, and the friend said, if you come to the city, I can help you find work, meaning New York City. So she went down to New York City, not knowing that her friend was being controlled by a trafficker, and quickly got picked up in a vehicle by this guy, and they drove around and showed her to all the other traffickers, aka pimps, in the area, and said, this is my new property. She belongs to me. Now, sometimes we think that trafficking involves kidnapping and holding people against their will. When you think about a domestic violence victim and you wonder why an individual would stay with someone who is physically assaulting them and has so much power and control over them, you know, for those of us who've not been in that situation, we think, you know, gosh, just come and we'll help you. We'll help you with this. You don't have to stay in that situation. But there's a thing called trauma bonding. And they become so attached to that person, they think that that individual loves them. And so they become so connected to them that they can't think. Honestly, guys, that's one of the hardest things for our residents to understand, that the guy that trafficked them doesn't love them. It's heartbreaking. And they keep thinking, like, they have this glamorous ideal that they can go back even after they're well and try to help this person because they still think this guy loves them, which is the biggest lie that we have to help break for them. So they obviously don't know what they're getting into. They don't willingly commit these acts. They have a lot of shame as a result of it. That's another thing that, you know, they just feel guilt. They feel shame. They feel like they have let their families down, unless it was the family, obviously. Victims are not paid for their services. They are given money that then is handed over to the trafficker. The trafficker controls everything. So this individual that I've been working with since 2014 that went to the city to work, she actually was allowed to come home because she had three kids that lived with her every other week. She was allowed to come back and be with them as long as she showed back up down there. Now, why would she go back? What do you think? She was afraid her kids were going to get hurt. She didn't get the money. The trafficker got the money. He paid her rent. He made sure she had enough food, and that was it. And she's lived in poverty her entire life. And so, you know, just having food on the table and a place to call home was huge for her. So she was deathly afraid that her kids were going to be hurt by these guys. And so she would go back over and over and over again until she got to a place where she could say, enough is enough. I don't want this for myself or my kids. And she kind of stood up to them. In fact, sometimes she stands up to them more than I want her to when she's posting stuff on their Facebook pages, calling them out as traffickers publicly. And I'm like, good for you, but don't do that, you know, because you're putting yourself and your kids in more danger because now they're going to be in trouble. So they sometimes do have freedom of movement. Sometimes they don't. It just depends on the trafficker. Sometimes they're literally locked in a room and told they can't leave. We had a resident who was with us for a year who told me that that was her story. And the crazy thing is, they locked her in her own house, in a room, in her own house, the house that she owned. They came in, they took over, and she was trafficked in her own home. There were opportunities for escape, but the victim didn't. Again, that mind control, but also fear. You know, if they're afraid to go back, they're afraid to report, even if they can get out, because they know how evil these people are, and they know how much power and control they can have, and so they're deathly afraid of that. One individual in our program, she was a young lady, she was 18 when she came to us, and I remember her telling me one day, I should have left sooner, and she was really beating herself up over it, feeling like, I should have done something, I did nothing, and I'm like, you were a child, you know, you were 14 years old, you were 15 years old, you were 16 years old. Of course you're not going to face these guys who are holding you and, you know, making you kneel on rice and hold books in the air for your punishment when you did do something wrong as torture. Obviously you're afraid of these people and you don't feel like you can just, you know, see you later, I'm out of here. So they beat themselves up over everything. Trafficking involves the crossing of borders, not always. Obviously, that happens. But the women that we serve are all living within the United States and have all been from the United States. It can't be trafficking when the trafficker and victim are related or married. That is also a lie. I had a woman reach out to me and ask me if I would meet her at the grocery store cafe, and I went to meet with her. She had been married to this guy for 37 years. And they were, obviously, he was controlling the entire time, but about 11 years before I met with her, he started watching porn. And from that day on, he started making her have sex with other men for money. And so she ended up in a trafficking situation in her own home, and she was married to the guy. When we first started doing work, we hadn't even opened our home yet when I met with her, and I remember her coming to, have you guys heard of the Healing Journey that Family Life does? So we started a Healing Journey class for survivors of sex trafficking. And she came the first night to class, and she was there 10 minutes, and she just started shaking and crying, and she said, I can't be here, I can't do this, he's going to know I'm gone. He checks the gas mileage in the car, or you know how much gas has been used, how many miles are in the car, and she was deathly afraid to stay, and she left. And I believe she's still with him. So even though we're here to help, doesn't mean we can always help, because they have to be willing to kind of be bold and be brave, and it takes a lot for them to come forward and want the help. So if you are in a profession, anyone in a service profession, medical, school, social work agencies, working with kids, I see a couple of hands, pastors, you know, any of those things. If you're in a role like that, there's a chance that you're going to run into somebody who is a trafficking victim. You think about kids that go to school. There are students who go to school and do school, and then at night at home, they are being controlled by someone forced to do their work, you know, having sex, performing sexual favors, getting paid to pay this trafficker. kids that come in and out of school. So kids you might see missing a lot of school, there's a chance that those kids, I mean, obviously it's not always that, but there is a chance that they could be someone who is a victim of trafficking. They're not far from here, actually, near Cuba, New York. I was speaking, and a doctor came up to me after I was done and told me that a young lady that he was a doctor to this child. She was now like 21 years old, but when she was 17, she went to a ball game, and after the game, she asked these two friends to give her a ride home. They stopped at the friend's house, and they invited her in. They had to pick something up before they could take her home, offered her a soda, but there was a date rape drug in the soda, and she drank it. And then they raped her, and they videotaped it, and they used that for like the next 3 or 4 years to control her, saying, if you don't do what we want, we're going to show everybody. This is going to be on social media. This, your parents are going to know about this. So somehow they twist it and make her feel like it's her fault because she wasn't supposed to go home with these guys. And so she ends up in this very obviously unhealthy, controlling situation. No one knew about it until her dad got a job transfer. And when he got transferred, she went and told her parents everything. And they were able to get her the help that she needed. So sometimes you have to just kind of go with your gut if you feel like something isn't right with somebody. Things that you might look for, and this could be a friend's child, it could be your own child. Pray that doesn't ever happen. But if they have items in their possession, such as hotel, escort service, business cards, that might not happen in Wellsville, you know, but hotel keys, a number of condoms, presence of an overly controlling or abusive boyfriend or girlfriend, or another individual. By the way, traffickers are not always men. I remember giving a presentation with one of the women that I work with, who she was coming with me on occasion just to help out. And when I finished, she goes, you need to tell people that traffickers are women too, because I was trafficked by a woman. And so I'm like, I will always tell people that from now on. excessive amounts of cash, chronic runaway homeless youth, signs of branding. A lot of our girls have tattoos that the traffickers brand them as their property. Lack of knowledge about a given community. They don't always know where they are. So, for example, the girl who was traveling around in the back of the box truck, she ended up getting into a fist fight with the woman who was at the back of the truck to keep them all in, and kind of forced her way out onto the streets. Had no clue what city she was in when she did that. They may come into an emergency room not knowing where they are. You know, they're under so much control, they don't even know physically where they are as far as location. Inconsistency in stories. Kids coming into school and telling lots of different stories that you're trying to put the pieces together. Things don't seem to fit. Lying about their age, having false ID. Sometimes they have weapons that they carry just to protect themselves. Style of clothing and shoes that may not fit the season, other things. And obviously you can't just take one of these things. I know you guys are really smart, so you know that. You can't just take one of these things and say, oh, this must be a trafficking victim. But when you start looking at the pieces, for example, someone who has the inability or is fearful of making eye contact, injuries, signs of physical abuse or torture, restricted or scripted communication. If they go to the doctors and the other person does all the talking, they're not allowed to say anything. They might have an attitude, defensive, rude, evasive, aggressive, demeanor, fear, anxiety, depression, submissive, tense, nervous. When I read this list, it just reminds me of our residents. We have one young lady in our program right now who came to us with a baseball cap. My two friends, Karen and Lisa, know who I'm talking about. They both work with the residents in a volunteer capacity. When she first came, her baseball cap was down over her face for probably, Karen, a good month, at least, maybe 6 weeks. So every time I talked to her, I was like this, you know, trying to look under there so I could make eye contact with her. And I would, you know, say, hey, can you just push that up a little bit so I can see your eyes? And now she's walking around the house without her hat on, unless she's having a bad day, then that cap is back on. But most of the time, you know, the cap is off, and she's got such an incredible personality. You can't help but love this girl. But all of this stuff, you know, all of this stuff, fear, anxiety, depression, every resident that we've had in our program suffers from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm actually reading a book right now called The Body Keeps the Score, and they often say that a victim of trafficking, what they experience is similar to somebody who has been through combat. And when you think about what that means, you know, I mean, these girls are raped multiple times a night. Multiple times a night. They say, I think it's like 9,000 times. I'm trying to remember if that's like the average time that an individual who's been trafficked has been raped 9,000 times. Because their life expectancy is not that great. You know, if they make it through 7 years, they're lucky. All of the residents in our home right now are in their 20s. So we've had residents in our home, as I think the oldest was 48, 47 or 48. And I can tell you that, man, when they're 47, 48 years old, they have years and years and years of trauma, and it's so hard. I mean, even the ones we have now, like the one that has her baseball cap down is 28, and she started, I think she was trafficked for 10, she's been trafficked for 10 years. So 10 years of this. We talked about what it looks like in a rural community. Sometimes things like massage parlors, strip clubs, hotels, private homes. Just because a house looks pretty on the outside doesn't mean it can't be a trafficking home. If you could see my computer, I usually have a presentation, but we couldn't make it work, so I was able to change the slides. But I have a picture of a mansion, and I have a picture of a boarded-up house. Both are actual pictures of trafficking homes. When you think about individuals, like in a massage parlor, sometimes nail salons, I know that that's been a thing here in the U.S., do the individuals have freedom of movement? Do they live and work in the same place? Do the workers owe a debt to their employers? One of our residents believes with her whole heart that she owes a debt to her traffickers. She feels like this girl, you just need to pray. Pray for all of them. But this girl just feels everything so intensely, and she feels such loyalty that she feels like if she doesn't pay this debt back, she's doing something wrong. And I keep telling her, but they're criminals. You don't understand. They're not allowed to have this debt over you. What they're doing to you is not okay. So we're getting there. We're getting there. Do they have control over their own legal documents? Most of our residents don't come with any identification. It's really difficult. Like, they don't have birth certificates, social security cards, driver's licenses. So we have to get all of that for them, which can be really difficult. Sorry. Are there signs of trauma, fatigue, injuries, other evidence of poor care? Are they withdrawn, afraid to talk? And every individual is different. You know, we have all these different women that come to our program, and you look at them and think, you know, is there any identifier that's the same? And the only thing I can tell you is that they've all experienced severe trauma. Other than that, they obviously have their own personalities. Some of them love to read. Some of them love to play the piano. We have this grand piano in our home that one of our residents just loves to sit and play and sing worship music. And it's amazing when you walk in and she's playing. So things that increase an individual's vulnerability: a desire to escape an oppressive home life, physical abuse or sexual abuse, online communication with individuals that they don't know. You know, when I go out and speak to students, I always ask them, how many of you have ever spoken online with someone that you don't know? And parents, I hate to tell you this, but the majority of their hands are up in the air. This is just part of their culture now. They talk to people they don't know, and they have access to people they don't know 24/7. And that's really scary. And that's why we have to have a really honest, open communication with our kids to be able to warn them, to tell them. And as you know, young people don't like to listen sometimes, you know, and it's important to just educate them in a loving way and invite them into a presentation like this. I love it when I see young people come in, because this is real. And, you know, the stuff that our residents have gone through, nobody should ever have to go through. So chronic runaways, homelessness, exposure to drugs, attraction to material goods, individuals who have grown up in severe poverty, or homeless, you know, they're desperate. They don't know what to do for themselves or how to survive, and so they just kind of fall into the hands of somebody who's not going to do the right thing for them. They have an innate longing for affection, and that's why they keep thinking that this guy loves them. But they all, and I remind our residents of this all the time, every single one of them that comes to our home, is that they are survivors because they have made it to the home. You know, somehow they've gotten out of the situation that they were in and they've made it to us. I'd love to be able to tell you that all of them that come to us stay, go through the year-long program, you know, graduate with flying colors, and, you know, they're doing great things. I will tell you that we have residents who do that, and then we have some who, because most of them have been addicted to heroin, meth, crazy drugs, that's the one thing that seems to pull them back so quickly. They start thinking about the drugs, and they have a pull to go back and use it. In our program, we're set up Monday through Friday from 9 to noon and 1 to 4. They take classes on things like PTSD and trauma, healthy boundaries, codependency, entitlement, sexual abuse. I'm trying to think, there's a few more. But all of these classes are designed to give them an opportunity to learn more about it. You'd think that because they've experienced this stuff, they would know how to avoid being vulnerable again, but they don't. You know, that's something that we have to teach them. This is what you fell prey to before. We don't want this to happen to you again. So I tell them stories about women who have left our program and who've fallen back into the hands of a completely different trafficker. And it's very scary, but they have to learn how to have those boundaries. Actually, Karen teaches our boundaries class and does a phenomenal job with them. But they're so, you know, the ones who really, really, really want to make it work and want to get well, they're scared. They're scared to go back out into the world because they know that they just don't have great boundaries. And, you know, I can think of one of our residents who just, she loves people and she is very, very selfless, and she would do anything for anybody at her own expense. And that in itself makes her vulnerable. So who are the traffickers? 36% immediate family. 36% immediate family. Boyfriends, 27%. Friends of family, 14%. Employees, 14%. And strangers, the smallest percentage, 9%. So I think, you know, coming into this whole thing for me, I used to think it was strangers was number one. It's not. Immediate family is the largest percentage. So what do traffickers do to control a victim? They restrict their movement. They create a dependency, which is what we talked about before, that trauma bonding, using psychological, emotional, and physical abuse, similar to domestic violence victims. They will also control victims by creating fear in them and dressing customers to look like clergy and law enforcement on purpose, because then they believe that everybody is involved. They can't go to the police. They can't go to the church. Everybody's involved. So how are they ever going to get away? How are they going to be safe? We're working on a case right now with one of our residents, and that's one of her biggest fear. Actually, two of them. Their biggest fear is going back in to the community, getting the help that they need with our help and with law enforcement help, because they're afraid that all of the law enforcement is crooked in the community. Because that's what they were told. Now, sometimes that's true, unfortunately. Not always. But they believe that it's always. They're taught to believe that it's always. So traffickers, sometimes, we talked about this before, will restrict movement and they create that dependency. There's two types of traffickers, though typically they start out one way and they both end up in the same place. So they call them either Casanova or Romeo pimp, and these are the guys who pretend to be the boyfriend. They woo them. They, you know, buy them flowers. They build a relationship with them where this person thinks, this guy loves me. And then he'll say something like, you know what? We don't have enough money for rent this month. I really need you to do me a favor. I have this friend, and he's willing to pay you to have sex with him. Would you just do it this one time so that we can get back on our feet? And because she's already fallen for this guy and she's so vulnerable already, she'll say yes. And then she ends up doing it, and that's the beginning. And then it continues on and on and on. The gorilla pimp is a very violent pimp. He doesn't care. He uses force. He will sexually torture these individuals. Some of the stuff that they've shared with me just makes you want to pretend you've never heard it. And obviously, it's hard to understand how they can still function. after what they've been through. Talked about from the victim's perspective, you know, they do fear law enforcement. They protect their family members because they're so fearful that something's going to happen if they say anything. And sometimes they don't see themselves as victims. They don't see themselves as victims of trafficking. They think that they were just doing their job. Like, this is what their job was. Like, you know, if you're a nurse, that's your job. They thought that's what they did, and that's because that's what they've been told to do. So when they come to us, we've even had women say, well, I don't really feel like I belong here because, you know, I wasn't held captive. I wasn't. So even helping them understand that what happened to you psychologically is the same thing as a physical bondage. They definitely feel shame. They feel like they have to pay back their debt. And they viewed their situation as temporary, like someday I'll be able to get away from this, but it doesn't happen in a good way. So, talked about those things. I'm just kind of flipping through some of these. So what do you do if you suspect an individual is a trafficking victim? Obviously, don't ask them if they're being sex trafficked because they don't even probably understand or know. And don't ask them if they're a slave because they're not going to identify that way. The first thing you want to do is get them away from anyone, family, and see if you can separate them from the individual who is controlling them. And then have someone who is trauma-informed interview the individual. This is usually a social worker, a SANE nurse, somebody who, sometimes they're a law enforcement, if you have a crisis pregnancy center, rape crisis center, some of those individuals are trauma-informed and can do those interviews. Trained community nurse, any mental health professional. And then there's a bunch of questions that you can ask or they would ask. Do I have any social workers in here or nurses? Okay. Nurse. So, you know, just questions that you can ask. Who are you living with now and with whom? Do you go to school? This is for someone who's under the age of 18, obviously. Do you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend? If so, how old is she or he? Are you sexually active? If so, how many partners have you had in the past 2 weeks, 6 months? Is anyone pushing you to do something you don't want to do? Has anyone ever asked you to have sex in exchange for anything you wanted or needed, such as food, shelter, money? Has anyone ever asked you to have sex with anyone else or multiple partners each night? Do you have to meet a quota of money before you can safely return home? This reminds me of one of our residents. We had an individual, I'm going to break in a minute and let you guys ask some questions, but one of our girls came to us from Brooklyn, and we actually did a rescue for her, rescue mission, where we went in and brought her back. And she told me about this thing called Thirsty Thursdays. All these young girls would go on their computer, all the trafficking victims would go on their computers by order of the trafficker and go through their friend list and invite friends to come to a party. And these girls would go to the party and the trafficker would have all kinds of drugs and alcohol and everything there. And that's how this started for them. And then they become dependent and then they end up in the hands of the trafficker. I was having my teeth cleaned one time, and my hygienist told me that her niece was offered $100 by a drug dealer to use heroin for the first time. And she said yes, and she quickly became addicted and then was trafficked by this guy. So obviously this is a hard topic, and there's a lot of stuff that you know, we can be worried about, we can stress about, And with good reason. I mean, I don't look at the world the same that I used to, obviously. But I can tell you that if you educate and talk with your kids and talk with the kids in your life, and just be there, be a friend to somebody. If you know someone, especially women, guys, a woman who's going through a really hard time and doesn't know how she's going to provide for her family, as the body of Christ, as the church, we should be stepping in and doing stuff to help prevent her from turning to something to take care of her kids that she doesn't want to do. You know, it's up to us to help people, to help others. If you do suspect that someone's a trafficking victim and you're in a situation in your profession or even in your own life, things that you want to do, like, I don't know, at your place of work where you are a nurse, if you guys have a list of trafficking indicators, have you done any training? So that's a really important thing, no matter where you work. If you're a firefighter, if you're a law enforcement, if you're a nurse, a school teacher, everybody should be doing this so that you can understand what trafficking looks like, how to separate a victim from a trafficker should be in your plan. You should have a designated interviewer, somebody that's going to do that interviewing, and a mandatory reporting procedure. And then obviously reporting to law enforcement. Depending on where you are, law enforcement has more or less education on the topic, which can be a good thing or a bad thing. I'm not going to lie. If they don't have, like when I first started in Corning, law enforcement in Corning thought that we were crazy. It doesn't happen here. So it took a lot of education to help them understand that it happens everywhere and what it looks like. And then I did a training for a bunch of law enforcement. And the guy that called me to ask me if I would send him some information so he could do the training, he goes, I know it doesn't happen here. And he lived in Elmira. And I'm like, well, you know what? Why don't I just come do the training for you? And so when I finished the training, he walked outside with me and he said, wow, there's so many things I think I've missed over the years that could have, you know, I could have maybe stepped in. It could have been trafficking and I did nothing. So training is so important. But you want to get as much information about the individual as you can, the one being trafficked and the one that you think is the trafficker. So I gave you a lot of information. I would love to just let you know how you can get involved with us if you are interested. We have direct care worker volunteers who come in and spend like an overnight shift with a staff person at the safe house. And usually it's like 4 in the afternoon to 8 a.m. or 8 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon on weekends. We're always looking for more support that way. It's an awesome way to get involved and just to get to know the girls. Sorry, guys, this is women only for many reasons. We want to protect the guys that volunteer for us just as much as we want to protect the women in our program. And, you know, there's things that can be said against someone that we would never want to have said against them that aren't true. The women that we work with have had to manipulate to survive, and they still manipulate. So, you know, they're still working through all their stuff. You can also get involved by creating a fundraiser for us. We have a group called Rahab's Rebels. We meet once a month, and people create their own fundraiser. Students have done this for us. We have one woman who is a professional photographer. She takes pictures and puts calendars together every year for us and sells them, and she makes about $5,000 a year for us. We have two other ladies that have made wool mittens out of old wool sweaters, and they sell them for $35 a pair. I think they've sold almost 600 pairs of mittens since we started back in 2014 with our fundraising. Could be a spaghetti dinner. It could be a rummage sale. Donate the money. Anything. But obviously, we are completely funded by private individuals. We don't have any federal grants because we are faith-based. So everything that we do is through private donations. You can just give directly online. You can set it up on our website to give on a monthly basis. We have a Sponsor a Girl program where you can give $100 a month, and then you sponsor that girl or stay on to sponsor as many as you'd like. You can give less if you don't have that much, but every single bit helps. There's so many ways you can get involved, guys, men and women. So if you're interested in helping us out, talk to me because we would love to have you. Lisa, Karen, did everybody get a card? Does everyone have a white card? On the white card, you'll see that you can fill that out with your information. If you want to be on our prayer newsletter, if you want to get involved in some way, you can fill that out and leave it with us. We're only an hour away. That's not far. So if there's something that you would love to do, we would love to have you, and we can certainly share more of those opportunities with you. There's also just, you know, if you want to be in our prayer newsletter, if you want to receive our newsletters, we send a quarterly one out, but we send a monthly prayer newsletter. And that's all I have, so I'd love to know what questions you guys might have for me, if anything. Yes. 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 Sorry, I didn't mention that. They receive counseling from a therapeutic counselor, but we also do processing with them all week long with our staff who are trained to work with the individuals. Other questions? Yes. Right. So there's two things I would suggest. Reach out to us so that we can walk you through it and be with you in that process. There's also a national hotline number, which is, I think, on the brochure. Is it on the back of there, maybe? 1-888-373-7888. Somewhere. Anyway, that number, I can say it again, but it's the National Trafficking Hotline number, and you can Google it if you can't get a hold of us, but we're always available. So if you have somebody that you're concerned about, I had a mom who reached out to me a few months ago. Her daughter had met someone, she was in college, and she met someone through a chat room, and she was chatting with this guy in England. And he had encouraged her to secretly get a passport. He was buying her a plane ticket. This girl was going to leave without telling anybody. She told a friend. The friend told the parents. And they called me in to do an intervention with her. And she's still here, thankfully. But, I mean, how scary is that? Like, your daughter's just gone all of a sudden, and you have no idea where she went. So definitely reach out to us or another trafficking organization to get support in that, because there isn't really an easy answer, you know, to say, well, this is what you should do or how you should do it, because it depends on the situation. You know, in that situation, the mom was able to bring the daughter into the room, and we all kind of met together and did the intervention. That may not always be possible. Ah, oh. What are you thinking? If we, Yeah, I mean, if we feel like we can be helpful, we're going to go. So I don't really have a parameter that I can say we're only going to go, you know, 50 miles or 75 miles. But as far as speaking engagements go, we've been all over New York and Pennsylvania. So if we have somebody who needs help and we feel like we can effectively help, we're going to go. Does that help? Yes. Yeah. We have a resident right now whose family trafficked her. Nobody would believe that this family could, you know, they look good, they go to church, they're very successful professionally, have a lot of money, and they traffic their own daughter. So, you know. Yes. So I think it can look very similar. You know, if you have somebody who's controlling, typically a trafficking victim is going to be controlled in some way. And I would say that probably on a college campus, it would be drugs. You know, somebody who's become an addict, or you notice that things are starting to change for that person, you want to really pay attention. It can also be that psychological control, but usually there's some kind of substance, because that's usually, for a trafficker, that's an easier way to control them, because they know they need that drug, they need that meth, they need that heroin, and so they can control. And as far as on a college campus, you know, it wouldn't look any different, I don't think, than anywhere else where, you know, people are being paid to have sex with an individual. One of the girls that I work with went out with a friend one night, and she was still kind of walking the line trying to help find the traffickers in our area. And so she would sometimes spend time with people who were not the best caliber. She went to a bar with a friend with a couple of guys, and they were trafficking her in the bathroom at the bar. You know, they put her in there, and they had guys go in, and that's what they did. I would love to say yes, but no. And for our residents, they are scared to death. Because they've seen so much. They've seen their friends get killed. They've seen so much that they're terrified. We continue to encourage them to do that when it's the right time, when they're ready for it. You know, I was meeting with one of our residents the other day, and we were talking about it and working with law enforcement. And, you know, our next step with her is just to get her to write down names and locations. And she gets so close, but then she freezes up, and she's like, I can't do it. You know, she's afraid for her family. She's afraid for herself, honestly. Sometimes. Sometimes it's professionals. You know, in her case, it's a whole community of professionals. It's doctors who are trafficking. It's attorneys. It's state legislators. It's crazy. So it can be gang. It can be others. It makes you feel like you don't even know who to trust, right? You know, that's the hardest thing. But Holy Spirit, you know, give me discernment. Help me to know who I can trust. Yes. So we do a lot of education with them on how to recreate their identity so that they are not, you know, on social media posting as themselves and connecting with people from their past. That's the biggest thing. Some of them want to get new names, new social security numbers, so that they don't have any record of who they are and where they are. So we've even traveled to different locations to take money out of their bank accounts. Like I'm saying, different states to take money out of their bank accounts to start a new account for them so they have it, because the trafficker had their bank account information. And so if they see money coming out of the account where it came from, then they think they know where the person is. But we're smart. Hopefully all the time. Yes. Yeah. Are you guys familiar with ACEs? It's a 10-question document that, you know, there's these questions that you ask yourself to see how much kind of trauma you've had in your own life. And, you know, the higher you score, obviously, the more vulnerable you are for a trafficking situation. And they use this in a lot of different situations. What do you do for work? Okay, yeah. So, you know, it's definitely, look it up. It's adverse childhood experiences, something else. But yeah, and don't feel bad if you have a bunch. It doesn't mean, you know, a lot of us have been through a lot of stuff. Anything else? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep. Few and far between, but we do. One of the individuals, the one that I shared earlier, went to New York City to work with a friend. She's never, ever used substances. And so I honestly think her PTSD is more intense because she remembers everything. And, you know, for those who have had a substance to help numb some of that, I think in some, I mean, I hate to say this, but she just really cannot even function. You know, and it may just be her personality anyway and where she's come from, but it just seems that she has a harder time functioning and moving on than some of the other girls do. And we have others who that's not the case for them. You know, others who have not been addicted, who, like, we have one young lady in our program right now, and she's just so, you would never know it if you met her. Like, she's just the sweetest piano playing genius you've ever met, and very bubbly and upbeat. Yeah. Yes. So, absolutely, individuals who have had early childhood sexual trauma become more vulnerable. And I kind of explain it to our residents this way. Once you've had that taken from you, then you no longer feel like you have the authority to say no. That boundary has been broken. It's been severed. And so you feel like you cannot say no to somebody. And that's true for a lot of them. But then if you look at that, that's not typically the only thing. There's usually those ACEs indicators that show that they've had more trauma in their life as well. Looking for hands. Well, thank you guys so much for this opportunity, and I'll be here for a few minutes if anybody has questions. And if you want to return one of the white cards, you can take it with you and send it in by mail. You can email us, or if you want to fill it out and say, I'd like to be involved in some way, we'd love to have those. Thank you very much. So funny.